Hey guys, don't forget to check out the Street Cop Training Conference 2023, April 23rd through the 28th, Nashville, Tennessee. The Gaylord at Opry, what a center, what a place. We have amazing speakers, amazing training, five of the most impactful days of your career. Check it out at streetcop.com. You do not want to miss out. There is a room code available for a discounted room. Sign up now at streetcop.com. Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and having with me today a friend of mine, somebody that we partnered with, and we appreciate their cause. I'll let him give his introduction of who he is and what he does and the organization his wife runs and what their purpose is, and hopefully that some of that stuff will speak to everybody's souls and they'll jump in and give a hand for a good purpose. But none other than retired Captain Rob Sueza. And Rob, you can give everybody your 2-minute version of who you are and what you do now.
All right. Thanks, Dennis. Yeah, my name is Rob Sueza. I'm a retired police captain out of Orange County, California, just a small city here, about 8 miles from Disneyland. Started my law enforcement career when I was really young, got hired when I was 20, which is pretty unusual out here. Retired at around 50. And retired out as a captain, worked every detail in the department pretty much, ran every department at some point in time. And I retired in 2019. In 2017, one of my officers passed away at home in his sleep. And it created a situation where the family wasn't getting the support they needed. And so my wife and I, we started an organization called Blue Wives Matter. That's with a W, not with an L. And we support widows across the country. We pick up where the agency drops off and we try to help them financially, emotionally, with whatever needs. So currently we assist about 200 widows nationwide. Towards the end of my career, I went back to school, got my master's in social work, and now I'm a clinician working with police and firemen, working with addiction issues, PTSD, mental health issues, and I work with their families too. So that's kind of what I'm doing now after retirement.
Let's just start off with this. How can people find Blue Wives Matter, and what can they do for you guys that you need help with?
So we have a website. It's called bluewivesmatter.net. So it's all one word, bluewivesmatter.net. Read our story on the website. You can find us on Instagram. You can also find us on Facebook. You know, we are completely nonprofit. We are we run off the donations of other people. For many years, I funded it myself. And so we're constantly trying to find financial assistance. But we also need volunteers. So if you reach out to us, or you can send us an email at bluewivesmatter@gmail.com. Just let us know you're interested and we'll get you involved. Like I say, we support about 200 families right now. We just gave out a $1,500 scholarship to a young man who needed to go to school. Every year we take kids Christmas shopping. This year we're probably going to take about 30 or 40 kids Christmas shopping. Every month we send out patches to the kids who were left behind. And actually, Street Cop has been great because they send us patches every month that we send out to these kids. So we need help with postage and, you know, our donations of patches. Anything can help. So, you know, reach out to us that way. Or they can contact us at 714-350-3984. We'll be more than happy to talk to you about our program.
Yeah, I mean, we are certainly proud of the support. And I try to remind everybody, we have it in our training flyers. Yeah. We come to our training courses, bring patches. Maybe bi-weekly, we send over a box and usually a substantial amount.
We attended your last conference and we got some really great support from your people there. I mean, it was just amazing the outpouring that we got from people, and we made some good money. So the Street Cop family has been really good to us.
Well, listen, the cause is good. It's important, and certainly feel honored that I'm able to help. So appreciate that. Let's talk about some of the work that you're doing now and maybe some practical value for some of the listeners in the audience here. Typically, our podcast has been going really into a significant mental health direction at times, which is important because it's something that's been ignored for so many years. So let's go over maybe some of the things that we've talked about in the past, you and I, in our long conversations of, like, you know, some of the things that you're doing, what motivated you to do it, what were the deficiencies that you've seen in this profession when it came to caring for police officers mentally?
So, yeah, that's a really interesting topic because, you know, you look around at agencies and I talk to different agencies and a lot of agencies say, well, we don't have a problem. We don't have any mental health problems. You know, nobody's getting help. So we don't have any issues. And that's the main deficiency. You know, in my agency, I was pretty lucky. I had a police chief that came to me and said, hey, our people are messed up. Some of them are messed up and they need help. And he said, I'm not comfortable with it. And he said, I know you are. So he basically handed it to me and said, you just take care of it. I don't want to know who's involved. I don't want to know who's getting help. I trust you to take care of it. And so I started with working with a police psychologist and we sent our officers to him. It was 100% confidential. The only person in the agency that knew these guys were going were myself. My chief never asked me who it was. Our finance department, they get a bill. It just had a number on it. So they didn't know who it was. So we really tried to maintain a level of confidentiality with it. And so it was working really well. We were getting some people, some help. They were getting the help that they need. And then I retired and I don't, you know, their system kind of changed a little bit. The people don't go get the help that they need anymore. And so what we're seeing, what I see, a trend, especially in this part of the country, is there's a lot of these EAP organizations, these employee assistance programs that are marketing themselves to law enforcement agencies. And they're really attractive to these police chiefs because they're cheap. They're very inexpensive. They go in and they say, hey, we give you a membership. Your people come to us. It's going to cost you this much money. Well, what happens that I see and the feedback I get from cops is that they don't want to go to these EAPs. A lot of these organizations, they don't really understand police officers. Their clinicians are not cops. They're, you know, they may have training in PTSD, but they have other specialties. It might be eating disorders or whatever. So the cops, they don't go. They don't get the help that they need. So it's kind of a win for the agency because what the agency says is, hey, I'm saving money because not many people are getting mental health care. And then they're saying, well, nobody's going, so I don't have a problem. Well, they don't realize nobody's going because the healthcare is not sufficient to the needs of the first responder. So, you know, that's kind of one of the trends that I'm starting to see. And you know, my own agency, a lot of the officers, they stopped getting help because they didn't want to go to this EAP organization with people that didn't understand. So, again, it's a win for the chief because the chief can say, we don't have any problems here. Well, the reality is the problems are just hidden now because nobody's getting help. So really, to have a good program for mental health support for law enforcement officers, it needs to be confidential. It needs to be personal. These EAP organizations are good for a purpose, but a lot of them don't really understand, you know, cops. They don't, I mean, they market themselves to understand cops because it's a good niche. Hey, if I market to first responders, I'm going to get a lot of business. But the reality is they don't really know what they're talking about. So some of them do, but for the most part, they don't. So, you know, having a good program, you need to have more of that personal touch. And what I'm starting to see is, and as I talk to more cops all over the country, is they're not reaching out to help because they don't trust these organizations or they don't want to be involved in these organizations.
Cops typically fear, I imagine a lot of this comes from fearing being scrutinized, maybe losing your job because you're mentally unfit.
Sure.
At my old job, literally, if you said stressed out, they degunned you and sent you to a shrink that was a piece of shit immediately.
Yeah.
And you had to figure out a way. Now you're going to this woman who was used at times by the organization to get rid of cops.
Absolutely.
She had the contract and it was do what you're told. We're going to send the guy over. We want him not fit for duty.
Yeah.
And then you got to run out, get your attorney and go find another therapist who says you are fit for duty. Then it's your word against hers. And now you get this whole disaster and it puts the organ that's what they're using it for. So to cover their ass, I've seen it happen. You say the word stress and literally immediately hand your gun over. You're out of here.
Yeah. And my focus working with first responders is keeping them working, keeping them back, getting them back to work, you know, trying to get them healthy. The good thing about treatment of PTSD is it's treatable. You know, with the right therapies, it's very treatable and you can get people actively back to work and engaged. So, you know, my own experience when I was 24 and I was involved in a shooting, they sent me to a therapist and the therapist they sent me to wasn't even a department therapist. I believe his expertise was geriatric therapy. Well, I was 24 years old. I didn't need to be seeing some guy geriatric therapy. And it was a horrible experience. I went back the next day and told my captain how bad it was. And then they forced me to go see somebody else the next day who actually made a difference and helped me out. Dr. Larry Blum, the guy's an amazing doctor and very well known here on the West Coast, treating cops. And, you know, it's just the administrations oftentimes, and I know I was an administrator. We don't want to know that there's problems there, because if God forbid, if we know there's a problem, then we got to freaking deal with it. And so a lot of administrators, a lot of police agencies, they don't want to acknowledge that their people might have issues. And you're right. In many cases, you know, I've heard about, you know, cops going to, you know, you say stress and all of a sudden it's fitness for duty. And that shouldn't be the case. You know, I work with cops with addiction right now, cops and firemen with addiction, and our focus is to get them back to work. What is addiction? Alcohol addiction. Firemen, it seems like they use a lot more substances than I've seen with cops. But, you know, our focus is to get them back to work and get them healthy, and we can do that. But, you know, it's the administrations are, again, if they don't see a problem, then they believe there is no problem. And I think you've probably experienced that in your own career.
Rob, what causes addiction?
So, you know, addiction can be caused by many ways. When we're talking police officers, a lot of times the addictions will start with injuries. So a lot of cops that have addiction issues will start out with getting injured. They'll start them on some type of painkillers. They'll be on some type of opioids, you know, a Vicodin or a Percocet. And then that's where the addiction starts. But then we also can't rule out that stress is a precursor to addiction. So oftentimes we self-medicate when we're having mental health issues. We self-medicate because for the moment it makes us feel better, but in the long term, it actually makes it worse. So that's why you will see people that are experiencing stress, or you're seeing people that are experiencing PTSD. They go to the bottle, or they go to something that's going to help them relax, you know, whether it be, you know, marijuana or whatever it is. They go to those substances because for a brief moment in time, it can kind of block out what they're dealing with. It's kind of twofold, especially with cops. You have the cops that get addicted because of an injury, and then you have the ones that are basically stress related. And when I talk about stress, it's not just job stress. I mean, it's home stress. I mean, you know how it is when you're at work, you bring that stuff home. You can't leave it at work. You're not able to compartmentalize that kind of work. If you can, God bless you, then you're a good guy, because, you know, I was never able to compartmentalize my work. You know, I worked a number of details, crimes against children, all that stuff, it comes home with you. And so that stress level, oftentimes cops will turn to the bottle, or they'll turn to some type of substance to help numb the feeling for a brief moment. And then the addictions can start from there.
What does addiction look like? And are there different types of addiction? Maybe, and I don't mean by the substances themselves, I'm saying, is it always just the consistent thing that somebody's consistently drunk or using some kind of a vice? I don't want to say, because a vice can be anything, I'd imagine. I mean, from gambling to all this stuff could be these dopamine effects you're trying to have, and circumvent cortisol, I'd imagine, at some point. When should people notice that something's not right? Like, is there typical some red flags?
You know, you made a good point when it comes to addiction. It's just not about substances. You know, cops or anybody in general, you know, you get gambling addiction, sex addiction, it's all types of addictions. All of them will impact a person's life at some point, financially, emotionally, in their marriage, in their work. The thing is that most of the time the addiction is seen by somebody else, by a partner, by an agency, by a spouse, but it's ignored because the behavior sometimes it's kind of an acceptable behavior. So for example, you see somebody at a party and they're drinking 10 or 15 beers. That may not necessarily be an addiction thing. It could be, but that's oftentimes like a normal behavior. We go to a party, we're going to have some beers. Where it really starts to become a problem is when it starts impacting your life. You know, you're showing up late for work, you're missing work, you're having marital issues, you're having financial issues. And the thing is like every cop that I've seen that has had an addiction issue, it's always come back to one thing. Somebody in my department knew I had a problem and they never said anything to me. So sometimes that hardest conversation you can have with somebody is a conversation that could potentially save their life. It could potentially save their career. So you got to be able to step back and say, you know what, this is going to be a hard conversation to have with this individual, but you got to be able to have those conversations, because, you know, you could save your partner's career just by saying, hey, dude, you're hitting the bottle a little too much, or, hey, you know, something's impacting your work. Or, hey, you know, I noticed financially you're strapped, so you're working, you know, 40 hours a week of overtime. What's going on? Is it a gambling issue? Is it a spending issue? Is it a, you know, spousal issue? And then every cop that I've talked to that has had an addiction issue has told me the same thing. Nobody ever said, hey, you need to stop. Matter of fact, I was working with a cop recently with an alcohol issue, and he said it was known by his captain that he would come to work intoxicated. But they never said anything to them because they needed the staffing. So if we permit it and we allow it, then basically we're endorsing it. And you need to have those crucial conversations with your people or with your partners and saying, hey, dude, you've got an issue. We got to address this. We got to deal with it.
What motivated you to become a therapist, namely specifically for law enforcement and first responders?
What really motivated me was the death of one of my officers back in 2017. He's the one that we formed Blue Lives Matter for. He came to me. I was a lieutenant at the time, and nobody wants to go to the lieutenant's office. As a lieutenant, I didn't even want to go to the lieutenant's office. I hated being at work. It's the worst job you can ever have in a police department. You're stuck between the sergeants and the captains. And I had an officer come to my office one night, and he was just stressed out. And this officer sat in a chair across from me, and he just poured out his soul. And to have somebody who's at an officer level come sit in and tell a police lieutenant everything that was going on in his life, and the stress and the trauma that he was experiencing from some work-related events and his tour in the military and being overseas, and just to listen to this person and see the emotion coming out of him and not knowing where to go and getting a resource, I decided that I wanted to get more involved with helping police officers. And then he was the one that ultimately, a couple of weeks later, he died in his sleep. You know, he had some heart issues, and he was out on leave to help deal with his stress. I was trying to help him through the stress issues. He was out on leave, and unfortunately, he passed in his sleep, and he was found by his 12-year-old son the next morning. And that really kind of pulled at my heart. So I wanted to work with the families and the law enforcement officers that are dealing with it. Again, being a lieutenant and having somebody come in and say, hey, Lieutenant, I'm having all these mental health issues. I'm not well. It's pretty unusual. And so I kind of felt like, hey, if somebody's willing to open up to me about that in confidence, I thought that maybe I had a purpose, because that's unusual. And that's when I started working with cops more on their mental health and trying to help them through some things.
What have you learned the most that maybe surprised you working with cops and first responders as a therapist?
What surprises me the most is that when you start getting into their background, a lot of them have childhood traumas. A lot of them have childhood issues that are just unresolved. And I don't know if that draws them to the career. And when I say that, I'm not talking, you know, everybody's trauma. You can relate your trauma as being serious. And for me, it may not be that serious, but it could be anything from divorce to physical abuse, sexual abuse, you know, foster care, you name it. A lot of cops coming in have some history of some early childhood trauma. The other thing is that most cops, when they come in, I really think that they come in for a purpose of helping people. And a lot of people that have experienced trauma in their life, they will get drawn to careers where they help people. And for the most part, you know, they come into the career with that. And then later on in life, they kind of get tainted by it. Oftentimes they get tainted by it because of the community response, how they're treated by the community, and how they're treated by their administration. Good administration does not sit in their office. Good administration walks around in the hallways and talks to people and finds out what's going on in their life. A chief of police should know the name of every officer in their agency and all their children's names. You know, they should be supportive, not distant. And like I say, most cops get into it because they want to help people, and then something happens along the way. And it's either some type of an event, they experience some type of PTSD, some type of negative response from administration. I'm not saying all cops, but the ones that are having mental health issues, and then trying to figure out where that mental health issue started from, or where the that, you know, kind of the beginning is. Because once you figure out the beginning, it's a little bit easier to kind of get to the end and figure out where they're going. But again, a lot of them, early childhood trauma is present, definitely.
Do you see often at times these people that you're treating, they're coming in that are first responders, that they had a predisposition of mental illness or had a pre-existing condition prior to taking the job and maybe circumvented the system that we know that put in place is complete horseshit to try to detect early signs of maybe some mental illness?
Well, it's funny you say that. Some of those early warning systems to detect mental illness, again, those are being assessed by people that have no idea what cops do. You know, they go to school, they become psychologists, they specialize in an area. And so they just start treating cops and they start doing these assessments and they really have no clue. But I would say predisposition, you know, that's really hard to say. I would say this, that the ones coming out of the military, the ones that have been deployed, I tend to see a little bit more issues there. For a number of reasons. One, you know, they're bringing back a lot of baggage that hasn't been addressed through the military. They're not getting the treatment. And also, some military guys come in, they kind of equate the role of a police officer to their military role. And they quickly realize that they're not the same. They're very much not the same. I mean, we had a guy that worked for us for about a week before he resigned, and he was in the military, and he couldn't handle the stress of having the autonomy to make decisions on his own. He was so used to constantly being told what to do. So military people coming in, they tend to have some baggage oftentimes. But again, all this stuff is treatable and you can work with it. But as far as like the pre-screen, you never know what you're going to get. I mean, you could get somebody coming in through a police psychologist says that this guy's got no problems at all. And then 2 years later, he's the biggest piece of shit in the department. He's got all kinds of complaints and issues. And so the science behind it, I don't know. I don't think it's really that good. But, you know, I guess they have to have some type of scale or rating scale, you know, but things slip through. So.
Sure. I mean, you can learn how to circumvent the whole thing. So in fact, years ago for the civil service, I don't know if what the entry level civil service exam looks like in the state of New Jersey anymore, but I think 1/3 or at least half of the entry level position was through the state was a psychological exam. So we went to courses on how to learn how to defeat the system and get a high score. They were scoring people on mental health. Hmm. That's really how they were scored to get ranked. So you had to learn how to defeat the mental health portion of it. And it was, you know, it's just this consistent 10 questions that are asked over and over again in different forms. And you had to make them consistent. That's how you learned how to beat them. I mean, I could defeat any, if you're smart enough, you could defeat any of those questionnaires.
Sure, sure.
You know, so, and when I learned and really mastered the craft, that's when I started scoring very, very high on my exams. And it's not illegal to do. It's just your, sure. Yeah. It's not based on quantum mathematics or mechanics or judgment calls. It's basically, you know, I like to be with people, you know. Yeah. And 14 questions later is like, I enjoy being at parties, right? Like making sure if that's a number three, then the other one's a three too. It's consistency is the key to that.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is like in California, there's no one standard. Each agency has their own standard. So you could pass a psych for one agency and fail it for another. You can even go to the same psychologist for two different agencies, but they contract the same psychologist and pass on one time and fail on the other because each agency has their own standard.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's not set in place. As long as you meet that agency standard, then you can qualify. And again, I've known officers that have gone to the same psychologist for two different agencies. One agency they passed them on and the other one they failed.
What do you think the current contributing factors are for law enforcement mental health issues?
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, I think you and I've talked about this a little bit before, the negativity that's perpetrated through the media against law enforcement officers. You know, we all tend to get boxed into the same boxes, that one asshole cop that does something stupid that ends up on Fox News or CNN. And the reality is we're not all that way, you know, and that kind of going with the mental health, it's important, you know, when I address mental health issues with cops is understand that we're all people. We all want the same thing in life. We all want safe communities and healthy families. And we all want that. But for some reason, there's this, you know, the media push in villainizing what we do, especially when we're involved in a chaotic incident where our actions are good and appropriate, and then you just get torn apart. That exacerbates the mental health issues and makes it even worse. It increases the PTSD because not only are you being traumatized by the event, you're being traumatized by the aftermath of the event. And then, you know, people potentially showing up. I mean, Matthew Degas down in San Diego, he was involved in a use of force situation that was completely legit. But because of media push, they actually filed criminal charges against him for filing a false police report. He was eventually acquitted, but he had people showing up at his house. You know, Black Lives Matter groups were showing up at his house. They were protesting him. He and his wife had to move. He was ultimately terminated and he's fighting to get his job back. And all of that negativity from one incident, like I'll tell you, I started a long time ago. And I was around during the Rodney King riots. And shortly after, you know, you pull somebody over and all of a sudden you were villainized as being part of the Rodney King incident. I was never even there, but I was villainized for it. So what we see today, we were seeing back then. The only difference was social media wasn't involved then. So, you know, just the villainization of our profession. Again, we're all here to do good. And sometimes we don't do great, but our purpose is to do good. And it does. It tears on the emotional side of it. It tears on the mental health side of it. It tears apart the families. When I talk to families all over the country, especially with Blue Lives Matter, you know, and maybe their family member was killed in the line of duty or whatever, you know, they get the immediate respect from the agency and sometimes the local community, but they also get the backlash. They get the negativity. And that's just not right. You know, in today's society, we should not be villainizing people that are out to do good.
It's a wild time. And that's actually part of my closing statements when I teach is what a confusing time the world is, because we're taking the men and women who have shown up to do this job for, you know, essentially, no matter where you are, almost nothing for a meager, measly blue collar, lower middle class living. Some parts of this country, $12 an hour, $14 an hour. I heard one the other day, we had a guy not too long ago. I think it was Dr. Trevor. He said that where they were from is like $7 an hour. They're paying cops still $7 or $9 an hour.
Yeah, so Dr. Trevor's from Kentucky. And actually, when I was at your conference last year, I met a cop from Kentucky and we sat down and had a couple beers. Young kid, I think he was like maybe 22, 23 years old. And he was telling me that he was making $12 an hour and he was happy as a clam. He said it was the best job he ever had, making the best money he ever made in his life. And I'm thinking, damn. How do you do that every day? You know, I mean, I'm on the West Coast. We make good money here on the West Coast, probably the best money in the nation when it comes to law enforcement officers.
Maybe. I'll throw some Jersey numbers out there. Maybe.
Maybe.
I think we're one and you guys are two.
Yeah. I mean, we make some amazing cash out here. And then when I hear, you know, when I compare to what I was making or what I compare one of my first year cops was making to this guy making $12 an hour, he's happy as a clam. And I got a guy that's making $115,000 his first year with a little bit of overtime. He's bitching and complaining. You know,
Maybe you guys are better than us.
But it's amazing to see the heart of people that are in this profession. And I think that we need to do a better job of exposing that heart. The media needs to do a better job. People need to do a better job. It's so easy to jump on this negative bandwagon about, you know, cops are all bad, or I wasn't there for the George Floyd incident. I had nothing to do with it. I had nothing to do with Rodney King either. So why should I be villainized for these incidents that I had nothing to do with, you know? So, but yeah, I met some great people at your conference, and to hear what they're making and then also realize that they can experience the same mental health issues as a cop that's making $115,000 a year. It's the same thing.
What can a police administration do to help some of these issues that we face?
You know, there's been a big push for peer support programs around the country. And I think, I'm 50-50 on them. You know what? It checks a box. You know, we have to have peer support, so it checks the box. Unless they're engaging and active, I don't really think that they work too well. I know my peer support program, we spent a lot more time at other agencies than our own. And I think that those agencies got more benefit from it because there's more anonymity in it. You know, it's not stuff that's known internally. I think what chiefs of police and administrators need to do is recognize that even if they don't see there's an issue, there's an issue. And be willing to not jump to the conclusion that that issue is career ending or that we need to get them off duty. Or, you know, I've heard cops around the country who, like you say, they mention stress and they're put on leave. Well, for me, I don't know how it was for you. For me, when I was dealing with stress, I wanted to be at work because that's how I dealt with it the best. When I was at home, I was more stressed about work than when I was at work. And so when you have somebody that's got stress or they're dealing with PTSD, these agencies need to understand that it's not it shouldn't be a fitness for duty right away. Just because somebody says the word, like you said, the word stress or PTSD, or I'm going through something, sometimes the best place for that officer is to be at work. It's safer for them. I mean, suicide, police suicides through the roof. Many years ago, a friend of mine, he had an injury and, I don't know. I think they could have put him on a desk detail for a while to kind of keep him working, but they put him at home. And after about 6 or 8 weeks, he lost it. And he went to his police agency, grabbed a rifle, sat in a police car and put a bullet through his head.
Wow.
You know, so the administration response that somebody might have mental health issues or that there might be stress, the immediate response to send them home is the worst response to make. They do it for whatever reason they choose to do it. They don't really understand. But again, I think the best thing that an agency can do is have a good program that promotes anonymity, where officers can go get help without having to ask, where they don't have to report their names to anybody. And again, the program that I was running, they didn't have to. I knew most of the officers getting help because they told me, but they also had carte blanche to go to our therapist, who's a police psychologist, who also was a cop for 25 years. And we didn't need to know who they were. So, and, you know, promoting wellness. And when I talk about wellness, wellness is not just physical wellness. It's emotional wellness. It's types of wellness, you know, financial wellness. Police unions should get involved. Just to promote that those types of wellness.
Are there places where a police administration can find resources on maybe give them guidance on what their first step is or what is their, you know, what they can do for their people? Because maybe I'm sitting here, I'm a chief of police, I'm going, you know what, this makes sense to me. Rob Swayze is right. I didn't put thought into it before. I care about my men and women. I'd like to do this, but where do I begin, Rob?
You know, there's really no centralized place. And as I talk to agencies around the country, you know, some of them are forced to have these peer support programs through legislation. Some of them have never really done one before, so they're trying to put it together. And there's consultants out there and there's people that will help. You know, if an agency has some questions or some directions on what they need to do, they can reach out to me. They can reach out to, and I can connect them with my partner also, who teaches peer support and trauma support around the country. And we can talk about programs. If it's okay, I can give you my contact.
Of course, put it out there.
So my email address is rsweaza206@gmail.com. I can be reached directly at my phone, 714-768-1219. I'd be more than happy to talk to any agency that's interested in learning more about setting up some type of mental health programs. An initial phone call or an email to me, it's not going to cost them anything. I just want to help. You know, from your conference, I actually met a couple agencies and I've conferred with a couple of them not too long ago, too. I don't know if you remember, not too long ago, there was an agency that experienced the death of an officer and they reached out to you and you referred that sergeant to me. And I've had an ongoing conversation with that sergeant for the last 4 months since that officer died. And I've talked with their agency and I've consulted and given them some feedback on what they can do to start up a good program. So, you know, it's just about networking and talking to the right people. You know, there's very few clinicians out there that have police experience. You know, the Viking, who you had on last couple of weeks ago, he's one. You know, myself, Dr. Langus, who I work with, he's a retired police officer. I would just say reach out to somebody reputable and just ask the questions. There are a lot of organizations out there who represent themselves as primarily treating police and firemen, but I would look into their credentials and I would look into their background and see what their background is. Some of them have never been police officers, and but they're still very good at what they do. But some of them, it's a niche. There's money in it. And if you have to pay a ton of money to start up a peer support program, when you can just reach out to me and have a conversation and we can send you in the right direction, there's no need to be tossing a ton of money at it. You know, I can provide training, you know, we can provide training. Really just look around and talk to somebody reputable. And, but you know, I say anybody, any of your audience can reach out to me for any, and I see individuals on, telemedicine. I see one-on-one, they can reach out to me. I tend to work on a sliding scale because I know some people in some parts of the country, they're only making $12 an hour. I can't expect to charge them the full, you know, session. So if any of your people need help, they just need to reach out to me. And even dealing with addiction, I'm working with an addiction center right now, consulting with them, treating cops and firemen. It's interesting, though. I have to tell you the one thing that's really interesting, working with cops and firemen. You would think that they only want treatment with other cops and firemen. What we found is that most cops and firemen, after about the first 2 weeks of treatment, they don't want to be around their peers because they realize their peers are the same people that kind of kept them in that same spot of the addiction. And that's the one thing, you know, misery loves company. You get a group of cops together. You know, I mean, come on, some of the most stupid things I've done in my life have been with a group of cops, you know. And so what it's interesting to see these guys going through their addiction and realizing, you know what, I need treatment and I don't need to be around a bunch of cops because the cops are basically supporting my addiction. They were supporting me by not saying something to me. And again, I don't think that's purposeful. I oftentimes think that if you're in an agency and you've got an addiction issue, the reason why your partners aren't saying anything is they're trying to protect you, trying to help you, but it doesn't help. So it's interesting when you work with cops with addiction. After a few weeks, they don't want to be in a group with cops anymore. They want to be in a group with some guy that was living in a bush or some teenage kid that had an addiction issue. You know, some of our biggest success stories out of my center that I've worked for have been cops that have mentored younger addicts that were not cops. And again, we get in this profession to help. And that's really hard for a cop to come in and ask for help. And so, yeah, it's an interesting concept.
I think this is a good finish to our first session. I want to make sure that you're getting back on for another time and bring your partner next time too.
Yeah, I'll bring Dr. Todd next time.
We have a lot of good conversation and we continuously touch on different topics, even though we have a lot of mental health professionals on here. It never seems to be the same consistent thing. It's good to talk about addiction a little bit. And I just want to really emphasize that people really take a recognition of their behavior and ask themselves the question, like, is this really stuff that is pertinent or helpful or fruitful to my life?
Yeah.
And if you're even tinkering on the idea of being a tad concerned with some of that stuff, you may want to begin to explore whether or not you might have an addictive personality or an addiction that you're dealing with. You say that's a fair statement, Rob. I'm not a qualified clinician.
Yeah, no, that is a fair statement. That's definitely a fair statement. And if you think about it for a minute, our addictions aren't just, you know, substance abuses. Our addictions just, it can be our adrenaline. It can be our job. You know, one of the first addictions that a cop gets to, and you probably agree with me on this, is that adrenaline at work, that foot chase, that vehicle pursuit, that running to a call of a man with a gun, not knowing what's going to be there. There's a certain level of euphoria that comes out of it that you kind of get addicted to after a while.
Oh, yeah.
So
if you're not finding that euphoria through the job anymore, people are turning to other things.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I'll ask this last one too. I mean, can there be good addictions versus bad addictions?
Absolutely. There can be good addictions, you know, I mean, within limits, you still need to always have limits, but you know, family time's a good addiction. Understanding that you have to try to separate things out from work because you know, work can bring a lot of damage to your family. I don't know how many, you know, baseball games you've missed or birthday parties you've missed or Christmases you've missed. You know, you got to have balance. When I was a captain, I would always bring the new cops in and we would talk first day. And I always talked about balance. You have to be able to balance things in life. Your work, it should not be everything to you, you know, The way I defined it is that police work and law enforcement is what I did, but it's not necessarily who I am. Did it mold the person that I've become? Absolutely. But it is not necessarily who I am. It's just what I did. It's what I do. And when you think that way, you tend to have more balance in your life. If you're the cop that comes in and basically you identify yourself as a, you know, a narcotics officer, a canine officer, a motor officer, whatever it is, and you live that lifestyle 24/7, you don't have balance in your life. And that's not good. It's not healthy. And it's going to be destructive to you and to your family. And I would also submit that when you completely identify your entire life with your job, you probably have a greater level of mental health issues later in life, because we've seen it. Cops retire, 6 months later, they shoot themselves. Happens all the time.
As far as balance goes, I'd like to throw this in here because balance is very interesting, and I have to deal with balance quite a bit. But the one thing I want to hand everybody over is I don't think that there is one carte blanche way that you have to do things. I think balance is ever changing. Mm-hmm. And I think that consistently in your life, you get to play with the dials. And maybe those dials feel good for a week or 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then something changed a little bit and you got to readjust the dials. So you know, different parts of your life call for different types of balance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got to, I don't know if there's a better word than balance. You've got to make decisions on what's the most important, what's still important, what's the least important.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, life is ever changing, you know? And so if you're not constantly adjusting that balance, if you're not constantly looking at priorities and seeing what's important in your life at that moment, then you're not going to have that proper balance. You can't define it as, you know, you can't compartmentalize it. It always has to constantly change. You constantly have to be assessing it because life changes. You never know. You never know. Tomorrow, your child could be sick in the hospital and, you know, the next day, your wife could be leaving you, whatever it is. You constantly are having, it's a constant influx of balance, assessing what's important to you and what your priorities are.
And unfortunately, you don't have an option. That's life. And I don't mean to sound harsh about it, but at some point you have to recognize that that's life. And nobody gets to escape life. And escaping life at your own hand is not a smart move. Maybe balancing and adjusting life. And if you don't know what that is, listen to the song That's Life by Frank Sinatra. Yeah. You actually hear the lyrics of it. It's very interesting. And then you know Sinatra's life, you'll know why that song was wrote that way. And, you know, it talks about the ups and downs, and at the end, I'm not quitting and I'm going to continue on to showing up. And it's just worth it. It's worth to stay tenacious, stay balanced, take another step forward. And sometimes you look back and you're thankful that you just kept walking through the storm. Eventually, the storm's going to settle.
Yeah. And for your audience that's listening, that's close to retirement, really, you know, and when I say close to retirement, I consider 8 years out close to retirement. You really need to start planning. You should start planning your retirement the day you get hired on the job, financially or something. But really take stock in what's important. Be prepared for it. Talk to other people that are retired. Get ready for it. Because again, like with Blue Lives Matter, we have several widows who husbands, they retired and 6 months later, they took their own lives because they didn't have that balance in their life. There wasn't that balance. It was, you know, what happens when the job's no longer there, you know? And again, if you identify that job is the person who you are, that's not necessarily the best balance. And oftentimes they crumble. They don't know what to do. You know, I'm a crisis junkie. If there's crisis going on, I can handle it. And I get super calm when the shit hits the fan. I get really, really calm. I'm a crisis junkie. That's probably my addiction. But a lot of guys, when that's not there anymore and they've got nothing to fix or they've got nothing to, or they can't help anymore, or their identity is not who they are. I mean, they're no longer a narcotics officer. They're no longer whatever they called themselves. It can hit them pretty hard and it really takes a toll on them mentally. And so I really say to your older audience, that's going to retire soon, take stock in that and really start to prioritize and balance things out. Be prepared.
This was a wonderful episode. You did not disappoint Mr. Swayze.
Good.
And I think a lot of people know that we actually have a pretty long relationship and pretty good friendship, you and I. And although I'm probably the busiest person you know. Always try to find time and get with you guys. And, you know, if I'm not always readily available, just know that you're always on my mind, that I want to always do things with you guys to support the purpose that you have, because I think we're all on the same mission in some sense.
I think so too.
Well, we'll do this again someday. Thank you again on behalf of law enforcement for being here.
Thank you.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.